I was going to, if it's okay with you, talk about a little bit about clear comprehension, what that means in terms of meditation. I'd like to start there, if I could. When we hear the word comprehension, we often think understanding. So if we're reading something, for example, and we feel that we understand what the writer is trying to communicate, we feel, oh, I've comprehended that. That's a typical view about comprehension. So if my mind clearly comprehends something that someone is saying, for example, that often means that I understand intellectually. I understand in my forebrain what it is that's being communicated or what it is that's being said. Make sense? That's a conditioned view about comprehension. Clear comprehension, when it relates to meditation, isn't about intellectual understanding. Because if intellectual understanding was adequate to bring us to a sense of completion, a sense of ease, a sense of peace, a sense of freedom, it would do it. And it would do it pretty fast. You just need to understand the subject matter. This is not about like passing a test. Like anybody in this room ever taken the GRE, graduate record exam, this exam that you kind of have to take if you want to go to graduate school. Well, there's a bit of stuff that you kind of prepare for to take that exam. And if you understand the stuff, you're going to get a better grade. If you don't understand it, you may be guessing at times, you may be lucky with your guessing, but it's also possible if you don't understand it, if you don't comprehend what these questions mean, if you don't comprehend in that intellectual way, you're not going to get a very good score. Now that's measuring a certain part of your, you could say, understanding mind, its capacity to get this subject matter and comprehend it. Clear comprehension, when it comes to meditation, has to do with the interface of awareness and experience. Some people would say experience and the experiencer, but there really isn't an experiencer, just like there isn't a witness. There's witnessing, there's experiencing, but there is no experiencer. It doesn't exist except as a thought. I am the experiencer, that's a thought. So the interface between awareness and experience with regards to clear comprehension means the innate, inborn, intrinsic, intuitive capacity that we all have already on board. All we do is turn towards it and allow it to awaken, or as it's sometimes said, allow it to be cultured, allow it to become a priority. What clear comprehension means is the observing nature of the mind, awareness, which is fully participatory now. Okay, it's not some like back there distant, uninvolved thing. It's not a thing, and it's definitely not uninvolved. It's fully immersed in life as life. Awareness and experience and the combination of two with regards to clear comprehension means recognizing what is going on without the filtration of three things: judgment, decision, and commentary. When the mind is in this clearly comprehending way, free from judgment, decision, commentary, this is where experience, life, your life, if you want to call it that, the life, clarifies itself and demonstrates its intrinsic, free, open, unencumbered nature. And that is revealed as what you are. Not something happening around you, if you are here. It is everywhere. And this is completely inseparable from it. So let's take each of those three things. Free from judgment, decision, commentary. Judgment. What does this mean now? This means the mind is free from comparing this to that, that to this, this to this, that to that, and round it goes. Comparison when it comes to something like, if I said to you, okay, notice that this room, at least in part, is made up of a ceiling and walls. No one's going to say, yeah, that's the wall. Ceiling. This has been conditioned into our mind. It's like no one in this room would say, that right there is an orange. And everybody else says, well, no, that's a banana. It's been conditioned into our mind what an orange is, what a banana is, what an apple is, what a ceiling is, what a wall is. And that conditioning goes on out to what a human being is, what life is. These are all conditioned, learned, actually imposed upon this innocent brain by those who had it imposed upon their innocent brain, by those who had it imposed upon their innocent brain. Back you go through the ancestral tree. Judgment in terms of floor, ceiling, wall, which is a form of comparison. No big deal. No big deal. If you want to call this a floor, fine. You want to call this a wall, fine. You want to call this a ceiling, fine. You want to all agree that that's what it is, fine. Okay? No problem. Start putting value assessments on those judgments. Bad, worse. Good, better. Way to be, way not to be. This view is better than that view. This view is more true than that view. This way of living is better than that way of living. Round and round it goes. And if you look at that process right there, this is where all the conflict comes from between human beings. All of it. Value judgments placed upon experiences, hierarchies created, and various degrees of imprisonment or impingement because of those value judgments. Does this make sense? And everybody, meanwhile, has some moments, at least every day, conscious moments now, not unconscious moments, conscious moments where the mind is not involved in value judgments. It's just naturally open, at ease. If that's inserted briefly between the moments of comparing and assessing and evaluating, then it gets missed. It almost seems like nothing's going on. Because what we end up with at times is a habituation. We end up actually with a degree of, you might say, normality with discomfort, with conflict, with tension, with friction, with a sense of life being in opposition with life. And even further than that, we become entertained by this phenomenon. It's entertaining to see conflict, to hear about conflict, to read about conflict. whether it's historically based or it's going to be something that's coming. There's going to be a conflict coming. What's coming? Let's anticipate it. Let's project onto it. And then, of course, what we call this in-between, the so-called future and past, this present moment conflict, this frictional sense of life. Survival of the fittest. However you describe it, it becomes normalized. But it is never natural. It is never authentic. It's an imposition. Now, let's insert perception into this moment. I've been talking about perception a lot in recent weeks. I'm talking about view. When you get to the area of view or perception, in all the schools of spirituality, we'll just stay right now within the different schools historically of Buddhism, which are basically three, the early school, the Theravada school, the Mahayana Tibetan schools, and then the Zen schools. And this has to do with the way the teachings moved and migrated geographically, starting out in India, that part of Southeast Asia, migrating north up into Tibet, China, Mongolia, coming eastward, crossward, finally ending up in Japan. And one can track this. And one notices, if one tracks this movement of the teachings, one also sees that there were particular individuals who were central in terms of the movement of the teachings. Awakened beings, various degrees of awakening, or fully awakened beings, would move to different places and then share the teachings. Sometimes as individuals, or sometimes they'd move collectively. Now, move that around to the other side, it really is, right now from Japan, the other side of the globe, we're over here in America. And teachings like this that I'm sharing are like tiny little, almost hardly newborns. We're barely out of the birth canal. Maybe we're just hanging a toe out. We barely arrived. Innocent little pink breathing babes. Hitting the air for the first time in the sun. It's just an analogy for how early we are in terms of understanding, clearly comprehending, hope you see the difference now, clearly comprehending, not just intellectually appreciating, authentic teachings of wisdom and compassion. That's what the Dharma is, teachings of wisdom and compassion. How to live in wisdom and compassion. Which if you think about it logically, you know, and you go for some clear comprehension intellectually, makes complete sense. If you can figure out how to live with wisdom and compassion as often as possible, wouldn't that be the right way to live? Wouldn't that be a good way to live, a wholesome way to live? And human beings who pull this off, they often comment towards the end of their lives, they feel very satisfied, they feel very contented, they feel very happy, and they're fully ready to release and die. Drop the body, let's say. It's called drop the body. Because you don't die, because you were never born. What is born must die. What dies must be born. You were never born, you never existed. So you can't die. Just like life. Life is not the opposite of death. The opposite of death is birth. Life has no opposite. And of course now, I'm pointing now into the more, you could say, non-dual view area of the teachings briefly. You'll notice, those of you that come, most of you come here, at least from time to time, if not frequently, that the way that I'm speaking moves back and forth between what the intellect can clearly get, hopefully. That's a progressive view. Oh yeah, that makes sense. I understand that. I can see that in my own experience. And then these kind of off-the-cliff numbers that come out of this mouth over here. You know, like that one right there. Life has no opposite. Oh, what are you doing? The opposite of life doesn't exist. The opposite of birth is death. Oh, the mind goes, that makes sense. Click, got it. Yeah. Comprehend. The clear comprehension that arises from meditation, that's lucid, open awareness, free from judgment, decision, and commentary. Decision. People say, well, what about that basic teaching where if you're not very, you know, settled, that you prioritize the breathing? Aren't you making a decision to come back to the breath rather than just drift around in your, you know, wandering, dreamy mind, passing out mind? You know, you're coming back to the breathing, aren't you, right? You're making a decision now. You say, yeah, you are. You're intentionally directing this wandering, discursive, lost, confused, samsaric, cyclical mind to get off the gerbil wheel a little bit. And it's a wonderful relief when people discover this. I remember discovering it for myself. I was like, sitting down, had insight 101 within about the first hour. I'm nuts. I had an inkling of this prior to this moment, but it's confirmed now. 100% certainty, I'm nuts. But that's what the mind said. I realized, wait a minute. There's part of this thing going on here that's nuts. What's this observing? Is this observing nuts? Not certain about that yet. So the jury's out. Keep sitting, Paul. It's just one way to sing about meditation. Okay. Pretty soon the agonizing quality starts to intensify. Uh-oh, this is getting worse. Definitely getting worse. Not getting better. This is getting worse. This is getting worse. This is definitely getting worse. This is getting really bad. I have never, ever been in such mental torment. I want to die. I need medication. Hospitalization. At least I need to stop this meditation and run. This is literally going through the brain in the first intensive 10-day meditation. And I was looking around at others occasionally, breaking the rules, because at that setting it was the don't look around. Stay like one of those horses on the racetrack. Poor horses, did they ask for that? Run fast, did I ask for this? Kick my ass, make me run faster. Did I ask for this? No, okay, here we go. Ever think about that? Dogs too. Run fast. What if they don't want him? Don't look left, don't look right. Because it'll slow you down. What happens is you begin to sit into the stream of life in a really open, honest way. Is you sit in some moments where you don't need to make any decisions. So how many decisions do you need to make when you're sitting here on the cushion? Where do I place my attention? Sure, there's a basic teaching that says let's get enough base of concentration, mindfulness, stability, so that you can tolerate a wider and deeper and more subtle expression of your life experience and not be freaked out, and not be confused by it, not be overwhelmed, not be frightened, not withdraw, and not start reaching beyond it to something else. Let's just say it gets intense. Can you hang out? Can you have resiliency? Can you have some responsibility to this circumstance? It's your life. And the teachings confirm this is quite possible. Millions of people have done it. Why can't you? Steady. Sit there. Not because you have to, not because you should, and not because anybody's telling you to do it. Because you can. It's a statement of freedom. Take responsibility for everything. discover that mindfulness is, in fact, fully responsive. And what I mean now is it's responsive in that it doesn't need to make any decisions, doesn't need to figure anything out. This is a great relief. No judgment, no decision. What's interesting, when people come and they meditate for a longer period of time, they actually get a real good feel for this. It can happen in a 45, 50 minute. By the way, we sat for 50 minutes. I'd like to, with your permission, I'd like to sit longer. We used to sit. I was thinking, actually, I had a thought during the sitting about how long this group has been going on. And then I remembered correctly, 22 years. Well, not to the day, but 22 years ago this group started. We've been in five or so different locations. Ibby's house, I was trying to figure out how long we were in Ibby's house. Felt like about 10 years. Other locations, different place. Been here for a couple of years now, something like that. We used to sit 60 minutes all the time, because that was the training that I received, 60 minutes sits. And we'd have to talk and so forth. And it slipped down to about 45. I'll bring it back up to 60. Do you mind? Mm-hmm. Great. And this partly came out of my son, who was here last week, and when I said, "You want to come tonight?" And he said, "No, I'm too tired. I'm going to do something else." He seemed very tired. He did a lot today. I said, "Okay." Not that I'd make him come anyways. And I said, "Did you like the group last week when you came?" And he said, "Yeah, it's stuff you talk too long." See, we have this thing. On Father's Day, he sends me a card and he says, "Thanks for almost always being willing to hash it out with me." I love that word, hash it out. And I said, "You're more than welcome." Okay? True friends do not hold back the truth. They're not intentionally trying to harm you, but they're not trying to protect you and make you feel good either. They're being honest. "You talk too long." You're right, I do talk too long. He said, "Longer sits, Dad. Longer sits, less talking out of your mouth." Try it out, see if you like it. You see, if you're looking for something from somebody else, then you might think, well, people say, "I don't want to sit that long, I'd rather have the talk." See, because this isn't about entertainment in the way that we're trained to be entertained. Like, "Distract me, please. Take me away from myself." And then people using meditation this way, they're going to use it tonight when they download that app onto their iPhone. And they're going to wake up with anxiety at 4 a.m. and they're going to use this pleasant music and this pay attention to the breathing meditation. And it's going to have a gong in the background going and coming. And they're going to fall back to sleep and they're going to go, "That worked. And sure enough, it's great. It did. It helped. You got back to sleep. And it might have been harder if you didn't have that app to listen to."
"Are you at my house last night?"
I don't know. I don't remember. I was all over the place last night, Eric, I'm telling you. But I wasn't in this body. I had about 8 dreams a night on average. Yeah. For now, deep sleep isn't really happening. This is just, things happen in different cycles in life. It can be frightening when certain things you're attached to go away, like deep sleep. It's not gone completely, but it's down, I'm going to guess, in about a range of an hour and a half, 2 hours. The rest of the night, which I only sleep about 7 hours, roughly. But the rest of the night, like 5 hours in there, or 5.5 hours, it's full on dreamland. And there's all these interesting habits. So I might have been there. I don't remember your house or anything. I don't remember you. But so no decision. Because you sit down and you realize, what the heck are my decisions actually doing? Well, if I make what I call a good decision, and I feel good about that decision, like, I don't know, I gave something away to somebody. Or I make a decision to, say, sit on my own every day. Or I make a decision to do a particular yoga practice. I make a decision to, change my diet, and I find the result of that to be good for me. I probably say, that's a good thing. I'm glad I can make sound good decision. That's fine. Okay? That's a byproduct of clear comprehension. That's a byproduct of discovering what it's like to sit and not need to make any decisions. That's a byproduct of discovering that metaphorically, your life is the sky, or your life is the ocean. Is the ocean making any decisions? Is the sky making any decisions? Is it trying to figure anything out? Is it saying, I think I'll be more blue this morning? No. True nature is not making any decisions. And yet, here's the contradiction, almost, not quite. It's more of a paradox, just the thinking. Decisions get made. Decisions get made. But not from the place of, let me see, what's the right decision, what's the wrong decision. It's more like, oh, clear, this is the thing to do. This is the thing not to do. And action comes out of that place. Beautiful actions come out of human beings at times. Tremendously wonderful actions come from a place. Did you make that decision? Not really. It just completely felt right. Didn't have to think about it. That's a byproduct of this third, or sorry, the second component of clear comprehension. Now let's do the third. Judgment, decision, here comes the third, commentary. To sit and discover, amazingly enough, that when this thing exhausts itself, it's almost like that, or discovers that it's possible to actually sit here, move here, be here, and not be making a commentary about things. This wonderful sweetness arises in human beings, and they often start smiling, laughing more easily, looking at wonder, looking with wonder, hearing with wonder, not commenting on the grass. Oh, look at the grass, this beautiful dew. But just seeing the dew reflecting the light of the sun on the grass. Bang! Completion. Fulfillment. Happiness. And this is just an example. Now, this doesn't mean that it's wrong to have a mind that's involved in making judgments or decisions or commentary coming up during meditation or when you're moving around in your life in what you call other times, which really don't exist, unless you say, okay, here's meditation and here's other stuff. Meditation, other stuff. Non-meditation. Awareness confirms there is no division here. There's not a category of meditation and a category of non-meditation. There isn't even a category called conscious and unconscious ultimately, although we make that decision, that division psychologically, this conscious life and unconscious life. Awareness is the matrix. It is the substrata. It is the continuum that's running through all of it. So what does this mean then? It means that this awareness is already itself clear comprehension. It's not going to become clear comprehension. It already is. You're not going to become clear comprehension or clearly comprehending. Comprehending clearly is happening. Hiding until it isn't. Innately, intrinsically. And here we get an interesting another conceptual sort of zone inside. Not really inside. Because if you look for it inside, you can't find it, and that's very important. Because inside is another concept that only exists if there's an outside. The concept of here can only exist if there's also a concept called there. The concept of you can only exist if there's a concept of me. And it turns out that these conceptual, you could say, polarities or dichotomies is where all of the friction and the entertainment, as many people see it as, takes place. This is where Fox News is, right in here. And then you say, enough of this friction. I want a less frictional area, NPR, right in here. I don't really want to hear any of that. I'm not even going to turn it on. And now it's just the mind. Conditioned mind. The conditioned mind, not the natural, original mind, the conditioned mind. And so then we go, wait a minute. Does that mean meditation's about getting beyond this? Yes and no. Yes and no. And what I mean by that? Yes, in the sense that if something in your life doesn't move you towards getting off the gerbil wheel, then your life is the gerbil wheel. But if something is compelling enough, it could be just the way the teachings appear, and sometimes it's a book. I remember when the first meditation book was given to me by a neighbor. She said, I think you might like this. It's called The Experience of Insight by Joseph Goldstein. I looked at the book from the outside and went, Experience of Insight. Thank you. I read a little bit of it and I thought, I should sit down. I mean, this seems like a deep thing he's talking about here. This huge tradition here that he's talking about. He was writing in very simple terms. It would be like a question and then an answer, short, brief, concise. More room on the page almost than there were words. Same friend next door, her name was Suzanne Peck. Suzanne Peck had a yoga book, and she gave me the yoga book. And it had all these pictures of the asanas. And so I opened a page 147, I think it was, and there was this advanced spinal twist where you take this and you go this way, and you take this and you go this way, and you take this and you go this way, and you take this and you go this way, and the head goes around like that. And you look at the stars and you smile, and I thought, I'll try that one. And I started forcing my body into these positions, you know, going, you know, because I was an athlete and I figured I can do this. And then I hurt my spine. Not bad, but I just like, ow. I don't think that's what you're supposed to have happen. Then I gave her the book back. But I kept the experience of insight. See, that was the progressive mind, saying more is better, you know, get to the end now, you know, not the finish line. Why didn't you just open to the first pose, Paul, that looks like this? You know, or maybe like this. You know, just a simple one. Why don't you just start with this? You know, something easy. No, page one. Now you got to jump to 147. You see, so the whole notion here of the progressive teachings, and as the Buddha laid it out, it was to capture the minds that intellectually clearly comprehending capacity and saying, does this make sense? Does this seem reasonable? Does this seem rational? Does this seem logical? If it does, then you can get interested. And maybe you'll start to meditate. Hopefully you will. If you start to meditate, then all of that stuff matters less and less and less and less. What you understand, your ability to make decisions, still going to happen as a good byproduct. Clearly comprehend the directions. I actually find myself looking for my son, if he's available, when something is purchased for the house that has these directions in 16 different languages. I'm sorry, 22. Right, and there's a section in there somewhere that's in English, upside down. Okay, and then it's in fine print, and usually, in my experience, not written very well. Okay, either someone was in a hurry, or they didn't really care whether you understood it or not. Quality control is slipping, slipping away. And so there it is, and I say, do you understand this? And I let him see if I can apply that, because he has a brain that can beat me in chess without even trying. He doesn't even need to pay attention to what I'm doing hardly. He can look away, and I'm like really trying to figure out what he's going to do next. And next thing you know, he's like, checkmate. He's like, I quit. So, you know, older brain maybe, you know, younger brain capacities are there. Whatever. Byproducts are wonderful, but they're not what the meditation really is about. So these people then, who come to the teachings through their mind first perhaps, or through the book first, or through the talk, or through maybe they met somebody who's like, wow, you seem like... People are drawn to monastic people sometimes just because they like the way it feels, or like the way it looks. There's a Thai temple in this town. And they had some Buddhist relics, and I didn't make it to the show they had, but apparently it was very, very, like, you know, energetic. It was very powerful, these relics. And so there's a community of people there, and it's part of their lifestyle. They have a lot of rites and rituals, but, you know, the authentic teachings may be coming through there in ways for people. So they're not just part of a community and feeling good about themselves psychologically. And, you know, I give money maybe, I feel good about that, you know. I read about these things, you know, we pray together, you know, we chant. Eat food, got to eat food. If you're together with other people, that's got to come up sometime. You know, it just doesn't tend to come into my dreams. I'm never eating in my dreams usually. Just skip the meals. It's like movies. Some movies you never see them eating. The movie goes on for 2 hours and they never ate. But it was spanned out over like 6 years. And there was no meals in the whole movie. Like, what? Do you guys stop to eat? What about just juice? Can we stop and have juice? No, no juice, no water. They never eat a thing. You know? They just skip that. Right. Okay, it makes for a movie. It's interesting. So people eat when they're together. But that's fine. And the socialization is fine. This has a sort of loose, you know, almost anti-social socialization here. You know, this one, there's not that many of us. And two, we usually don't hang around and say, you know, you want to come for donuts? You know, I mean, it just doesn't really happen here. Some people come to this and they go, I don't really feel very connected to people. See, they're looking for a social connection sometimes, and I want to talk, and there's no name tags. You know, try going to a conference, which you can pull this off if you want. Not that many, but they do exist, where there are no name tags and you don't get introduced. The way it is, you just jump into the sea with other people. I find it to be, initially when I experienced that, horrifying. Just absolutely overwhelming to the socially anxious part of my mind. And then I realized that I could do the opposite of what I'd been trained to do somehow, which was be anxious and self-conscious, and I could just jump right into the middle and walk up to anybody and say anything I wanted. And I found that to be an amazingly profound thing that I never even thought I could possibly do in my life. And all I had to do was make the decision to do it. Hi, my name's Paul. Or just walk up and say, hey, what's your name? Say whatever came into my mind. I mean, I'm not talking about weird things. I'm just talking about like socially sort of like appropriate things with total strangers. And it was wonderful. People would just be nice. They were open right up. Some of you may have done this and you might be thinking, no, what did it take you so long to figure that one out? It's really, really easy. Well, that's still a byproduct. A byproduct of the meditation. To be socially free. To be able to walk up to someone in a train station in a foreign country where you don't know the language and figure it out. Meet at that basic level of humanity. Be comfortable with that. And of course then be comfortable in one's own skin. You can't be comfortable in your own skin if you're busy dividing up the experiences inside the skin bag that are good and bad. If you've got that criteria. If you've got the criteria of pleasant, unpleasant, which psychology still has a lot of that in it, pleasant and unpleasant affects. Pleasant affects, positive affects are better than unpleasant affects. And they're evolving that slowly now, and it's getting to the point where it's important to have resiliency and to be able to tolerate both. And then finally we get to the transpersonal aspect, and it's like, let's see if we can tolerate both for the purpose of living amidst and beyond at the same time. That's why it turns out that meditative living tends to lead to as a byproduct. Better decisions, and if you're going to have a commentary, it's a commentary that's at least more interesting to you and might be more interesting to other people if you choose to open your mouth and share your commentaries. People find it interesting. And so, there you go, blabbing your mouth off again. So what I said to my son is, I said, so you're right, I do talk too long, but let me ask you another question. Was it good or not? He said, it's always good, Dad. That's my boy. Now you're listening. So I used to listen to my father, who was a minister. He'd get up in front of people, it was a very sort of Christian thing, he'd stand up in the pulpit, and he'd talk, and I was like, let's get back to the hymns, or maybe I can just stare at these stained glass windows. These are really interesting, the sun. And then all of a sudden he'd click into something. I remember him clicking in, I could feel the alignment in me, and I could feel the alignment in him, and I could feel the alignment in the room. And I started looking around, and I saw the alignment of truth. I remember seeing it one time when he was really sick. He had prostate problems, and his colon wasn't right, and he couldn't walk correctly. He was getting older, and he just lined up. I started crying because I was like, that's really good. Thank you. Thank you for not being my father so much, but thank you for this alignment that you're helping me have access to. So everything made sense. Everything made sense. This doesn't have to be reserved for sweet moments of witnessing a birth or the sweet moments that happen at weddings when it seems like everything's right. Everything's lined up. This is what life is about, right here. I'm talking about that resonance and potential of alignment, that synchronicity, that isn't here and there. It's what's happening all the time. And then you begin to see there's a trance that you thought was normal. And it's that trance that tells you, or seems to tell you, suggests to you. That's what a trance does. It suggests. It doesn't really tell. You are lost some of the time. You are lost in judgment, decision, and commentary. And what the meditative process does is it turns that inside out so that the capacity to have judgments, decision, and commentary . The Buddha had the capacity to make decisions, and you can make decisions for other people. He could tell them what was right for them and what was wrong for them. If they said, well, you know, we're going to move to this place, and he would say, I would not suggest you move to that place. Do not move to that place. It won't be good for you. He could see what was right, and he could offer that as teachings to people. He could tell them what to do meditatively so that they would awaken quicker. Imagine that. Imagine having a spiritual friend who can tell you exactly what you need. They don't just give you a kind of prescription that works for, you know, a bunch of people, maybe. But they can look right in you and they can see exactly what you need and can tell you precisely, don't move to this place. This is the practice for you. I don't know about you, but I'm not even sure I could recognize that if it came to me. I might think the person is just telling me what to do. Because there's a lot of people who, if you really open yourself up, they'll tell you what to do. They'll charge you money for that, and you'll join their herd. There's a fine line between a cult with a leader or two and someone who is truly coming from wisdom and compassion. So much they can see exactly what you need. See, because we don't know exactly what we need. That is part of samsara. That is why we're wandering. That is why we have doubt. That is why we have desire for things beyond what's happening. That is why we have aversion for things that are happening. That is why we get restless. And that is why we get at times excessively sleepy. Not just because it's time to go to bed, but because we're living in a certain tranced out dross that many people accept as normal. Things are not as we think they are, much of the time. Occasionally we get right thinking, occasionally the thoughts line up with correct view, and the mind brain has correct thinking, correct, accurate thoughts. Rare. Most of the thought stream is derivatives and filtrations of the habitual tendencies to live in judgment, decision, commentary. Judgment, decision, commentary. If you ever hang around monks, which I used to do as sort of a part of my lifestyle, actually, I found it fascinating, among other things, to see that these monks were doing very, very little. They were essentially about being. One in particular I remember, his name was Usalananda. He was from Burma. He spoke very little. Last I heard, he was living in Half Moon Bay, California. Very foggy place, by the way. Usalananda was trained as a monk from a very, very young age in Burma. Came to America for various reasons, was invited, I assume, was teaching here. Was not a super, like, charismatic dude, didn't draw a lot of people, wasn't particularly entertaining, but he was incredibly still. And it could, when I observed him in the stillness, I noted that it seemed to me it was in no way imposed, that it was natural. And it was comforting, it was very comforting to sit with him. And I remember just sitting with him and others in a terribly grotty place called the Unity, something or other, Unity something down in Brooksville. It was absolutely grotty and moldy and probably toxic and should have been taken apart. Rebuilt or not. But there we were, and that was irrelevant. It smelled. What was relevant was the stillness. And then there was a lunch one day, and after the lunch, I looked forward. I had this way of recognizing my make decision about what I'm going to do when during the day, so I don't have to make any decisions anymore. So I would set it up so I would have my shower after lunch. Just a routine, right? We do this. You can study this a little bit. You can see, like, oh, what's running the show? Why are these decisions happening in this way? And some people, oh, I didn't really make a decision. I take a shower whenever. No. You think you're doing that. There's a decision being made in there. Have a look at it. Anyways, I'd make my decision. I'd set it up. Okay, I'll take my showers after lunch, and I wouldn't have to think about that. I do my sitting, I do my walking in this place, I don't have to think about it. Go into the cafeteria towards the end of the lunch line, so I don't have to stand in line very long. Make these decisions ahead of time. I'd plan how I was going to do my retreat, so I wouldn't have to plan how I was going to do my retreat. Got it? So then I go for my shower after the lunch period, take my shower, I come out of the shower, and a shower of stillness pours down over the body. It wasn't just the body, it poured down over the mind. Everything's shimmering in a grotty bathroom. The mold is beautiful. I I could see it in the corner. It's beautiful. And I'm thinking it was Samananda. And my heart's full of gratitude. Simple. The mind goes, this is wonderful. I want to tell everybody about this. It's like Jim Carrey when he got connected to the teachings in one of his talks at some Hollywood event. He goes, I want to tell everybody about this. Everybody should know about this. Everybody. You know how he is. He's extremely excitable. Much more animated than I'm being. Imagine realizing that the way in which that wonderfulness gets communicated is not about histrionics. It's not about yapping. It's not about loudness. It's about living and recognizing that it's possible to stabilize in the awakening nature. Instead of, oh, I'm in it, oh, I'm not in it, oh, I'm in it, I'm not in it. See, because if you come away from this talk and you think, oh, the point is to get past decision, commentary, and judgment. No. Decision, commentary, and judgment will not leave your brain alone until the brain cells are pretty well done. The point is to see judgment, decision, commentary for what they are, to see their place, just like thoughts, to see their place in life. And it's through that seeing that you live amidst it and beyond it at the same time. You're in it, but not of it, like the Sufis say. And that meditative awareness, that true meaning of clear comprehension, is the gate. Okay, Gabe, you're not here, but I'm stopping. Mm-hmm.